Chapter 7. Christina. Capri, Italy, June 1891. In the Piazza Umberto I, or the Piazzetta, as Christina has learnt to call it, the black iron minute hand of the tiled clock in the Torre dell'Orologio clicks onto 12. The bronze bells in the belfry chime. Christina counts the rings as she watches her cousin argue with the vegetable seller. 8, 9, 10. She glances at the tower, which stands like a tall, sturdy guard over the cobbled piazza. The piazza bustles with villagers visiting the weekly market. The sky is a blue which she has never seen in England, pure and clean and uplifting. English blues may aspire to the purity of the blue Italian sky, she thinks, but they expire, greyed and puffing, on the climb to the pinnacle of blueness. Stefania Albertini is objecting to the price of zucchini.
No, sei un ladro. Voglio solo 6 zucchini, non 20.
The vegetable seller argues back in kind, as he does with Stefania Albertini every Wednesday, when he and the other traders set up their stalls laden with green zucchini, ropes of garlic, tubs of glistening black olives, tomatoes shaped like pears, aubergines shining like purple lacquer, balls of white mozzarella, wedges of parmesan, and wheels of goat's cheese. Twice a month, the town's butcher sets up a stall as well, offering tongue and offal, chunky pork sausages, lamb in the spring, a mutton later in the year, but he isn't in the piazzetta today. Today, the fishmongers are doing a good business, selling their stocks of anchovies marinated in vinegar, black-shelled mussels, sea bream, octopus, and cuttlefish. Stefania drops coins into Christina's hand.
Tina, go to the baker and buy 3 loaves of bread and 6 cannoli. It's in the lane around the back of the church. I'll be at the fish stalls.
Christina wanders past the church of Santo Stefano, with its pilasters and dome, the white paint of the once grand ex-cathedral now faded and peeling from the hot Italian sun. She pauses to pet an orange cat, who rubs itself against her hand, purring.
Well, hello there.
Christina squints into the sunlight. Harry Grenville smiles at her from beneath the brim of his straw boater.
You appear to have found a friend.
Oh, hello. Yes, he's very friendly. He reminds me of our cat when I was a little girl. Papa named him Ozymandias, though I called him Ozzy.
I'm not sure Mr. Shelley would have approved of that for his great king.
Harry Grenville holds out his hand.
What brings you to this bustling piazza today?
Christina accepts his hand and rises to her feet.
I'm here with my cousin Stefania. She's actually my mother's cousin, so I suppose she's my second cousin, or first cousin once removed, something like that.
She jingles the coins in her hand.
I've been instructed to buy some bread and cannoli.
She frowns under the wide brim of her hat.
Do you know what cannoli are?
You haven't had cannoli? You're in for a treat. They're crispy pieces of heaven filled with dollops of sweetened cream as light as angels' clouds.
Christina laughs.
You could have been a romantic poet yourself.
Not one Mr. Shelley nor Mr. Byron would have been too concerned about, I suspect.
No, I don't believe either of them ever used the word dollop in their poems.
He offers Christina his arm.
May I accompany you to the bakery?
Christina glances back at the fishmonger stalls under the clock tower.
Stefania's black straw hat is just visible above the heads of the villagers, crowding the stalls in their scrum for the best fish.
She slides her hand into the crook of Harry's arm.
All right, but I have to meet my cousin back by the fish stalls shortly.
I shall be sure to deliver you back in one piece.
They head through the crowds and down a lane beside the church. At a street lamp on the corner of a cobbled alley, Christina stops and sniffs the fragrant, yeasty scent that beckons them down the alley.
There, she points, where the canopy is, I can smell it.
They stroll down the lane, past white-painted buildings with metal balconies spilling over with red pelargoniums, and stop in front of the large glass window of the bakery with Pasticceria de Rosa painted on the glass in black and gold. The scent of baking bread, like a cloud of perfume, wafts through the open door. Harry follows Christina into the tiny shop, which is painted a fresh, bright yellow. Behind a wooden counter, a stout woman of about 40 in a black cotton dress adjusts her spectacles as she eyes the two visitors.
Si, signorina?
Christina glances at Harry.
How is your Italian? I'm afraid I'm not a terribly good student.
I thought you told me you spoke Italian.
Yes, well,
she holds up her thumb and finger in a pinching motion.
Un po'.
Harry smiles.
I should be able to buy bread and cannoli.
Wonderful. I need 3 loaves of bread and 6 cannoli.
Harry holds up 3 fingers to the shopkeeper.
3 panotti di pane e...
He holds up 6 fingers.
6 cannoli, per favore, signorina.
The woman giggles and says something to Harry in Italian. He responds, and the woman giggles again. She rolls the bread into brown paper and hands it over the counter. She points at the plates of chocolate and vanilla cannoli.
Cioccolato or vaniglia?
Oh, chocolate, please, Christina says.
I understood that.
As Harry places the order, Christina bites her lip and fixes her gaze on the terracotta floor tiles, willing her pounding heart to settle. Harry holds up a paper bag.
There you go. Cousin Stefania's order filled.
Thank you so much.
She frowns at her handful of coins.
How much is it?
No, absolutely not.
He reaches into his pocket and, counting out the lira, sets the coins on the wooden counter. The shopkeeper scoops the money into her hand.
Grazie, signor, signorina.
Outside the shop, Christina turns to Harry.
That was very kind of you, Mr. Grenville, but please let me repay you.
I wouldn't hear of it. You can use the money to buy lemonade at Leonardo's store.
And it's Harry. Just Harry. He laughs.
My father would shudder if he heard me say that.
Whatever for?
It's all very dreary, really. He's an earl, and I'm his eldest son, so I'm a viscount. We have an estate up in the Scottish borders, ancient and very draughty. Officially, I'm the Right Honourable Harold Grenville, Viscount Sherbrooke.
Good heavens!
Hard to believe, isn't it? I'm travelling the Mediterranean this summer to escape all that, before I attend Sandhurst in January.
Aren't I meant to call you Sir or Lord or something? Just Harry.
The bells of the clock tower chime, filling the piazza with their echoing clamour. She glances in the direction of the square.
I should go back by myself. Harry?
Are you sure? It's no bother.
She has no idea what her cousin would think of her springing a young aristocrat on her, but she isn't quite ready to find out.
Yes, I'm sure. I mustn't keep Cousin Stefania waiting.
Of course.
Harry hands Christina the bread and the bag of cannoli.
Miss Bishop, if I may, I found a path down to a Roman grotto. It winds all along the southern side of the island. Have you?
It has lovely views out to the sea. Apparently, the grotto was a nymphaeum, a shrine to water nymphs. I read about it in my Baedeker guide. There's quite a stunning natural arch to see on the way. I thought perhaps you might like to accompany me there on a walk. Well, it's more like a hike. It's quite steep, and rather a climb back up the hill afterwards. But if you're up for it, it brings you all the way to the Faraglioni.
Those rocks in the sea? You can get close to them.
Yes, very close. It's well worth it. I've been wanting to sketch them.
I'm not sure. Cousin Stefania was very cross with me for being out so long the day you helped me buy lemons. Perhaps I should call on your cousin to introduce myself.
Christina's eyes widen.
Oh, I'm not sure that's a good idea.
It's a very good idea. An absolutely necessary idea. You see, I have no intention of this being our last meeting, Miss Bishop. Christina looks at Harry from under the wide brim of her straw hat. In the sun, his eyes are as blue as the Italian sky.
The bluest of blue. Then, Harry, I shall look forward to it.
Chapter 8. Seeley. Victoria Train Station, London. March 1913. Seeley peers through the crowd of passengers disembarking from the boat train from Dover.
Seeley! Schatzi!
A slender young soldier in a rumpled grey uniform, his face the epitome of joy, waves at her.
Max!
He pushes through the crowd and, after dropping his carpet bag on the platform, sweeps her into his arms and kisses her on the cheek.
Schatzi!
He twirls her around the platform as she laughs, the two of them oblivious to the grumbles of the disembarking passengers. He sets her down and hugs her against the scratchy wool of his uniform.
You have no idea how much I have counted the moments until today.
Max, what are you wearing?
He stands back and pats the grey wool jacket.
Do you like it?
He adjusts the flat beret, edged with red. It's my uniform for the Landsturm. Do you think I look handsome?
You look very distinguished. What's the Landsturm?
In Germany, every young man, I should say, is required to do military service for 2 years when they turn 20. When I was at university, I made an arrangement to be a 1 year volunteer, to train as a reserve officer when I graduated, so that I could finish my studies and my teaching contract first. I had to have an interview and everything. It's very strict. I received a letter when I was home, then had my induction and got my uniform. I must join for 1 year next September.
Why are you wearing the uniform now?
To impress you, of course.
Fritz is quite upset. He wasn't accepted to be a 1 year volunteer, as his grades weren't good enough. He started his service in January for 2 years. He will have to finish his studies later.
Max, you don't suppose there's going to be a war, do you?
Don't be silly. Why do you think that?
There's been talk in London. People have said they've seen zeppelins along the coast. It's been in the papers.
It's just people's imaginations. I haven't even seen a zeppelin, and I live in Germany.
He picks up his carpet bag.
Come on, Schatzi. I have been dreaming about the fish and chips from the wonderful old place in Covent Garden. I hope you are hungry.
They walk hand in hand, past the soaring granite obelisk of Cleopatra's Needle on the embankment by the Thames. The turgid grey water of the river slides by like a huge river snake, and the evening sky is heavy with clouds the colour of charcoal.
I told Mama about you.
You said in your letter.
She said, why couldn't I find a nice young Englishman?
Max laughs. I suppose I should have expected that.
Max, if only she were to meet you. I know she'd change her mind. Everyone likes you. You're the most popular German teacher at the college.
That's not hard, when the others are Professors Obermeier and Clem. What does your father think?
Papa is fine. He understands me. We're similar.
We're both life's observers rather than life's doers. Papa loves nothing more than to record the world through his cameras. He used to travel around Britain when he and Mama were first married. taking pictures of towns and landscapes for the British historical record. He doesn't do that any more. It's mainly portraits now.
I look forward to meeting your father.
You'll like him. He's a kind man.
Your mother is not kind?
My mother is... well, she's my mother. She thinks I'm too reticent, that I need to come out of my shell. I feel like I'm a disappointment to her, and I don't know why. Sometimes I catch her looking at me like I've done something awfully wrong, and I have no idea what it is.
I'm certain that's not true, Shotzi. You are the smartest, kindest girl I have ever met. You could never be a disappointment to anyone.
They walk along the river in silence. Celie shivers and rubs her arm.
Something's changed, Max. Can't you feel it? On the omnibuses and the trams.
I heard a man on the tram just last week tell his wife to stop going to the German butcher because he wasn't going to eat another German sausage.
Maybe he doesn't like German sausages.
It's not that. Even you. Look at you in your army uniform, and you're not even in the army yet.
You don't like my uniform?
I prefer you in your normal clothes. That's the Max I know.
I'm still the same Max.
Celie stops under the brick arch of Waterloo Bridge.
Are you Max?
She looks up at him and removes his army cap. A street lamp throws a warm glow on Max's blonde head. She brushes his hair with her fingertips.
There. That's better. Shotzi.
She slides her hand along his smooth cheek. A groan escapes Max's lips. His breath is warm on her fingers. He drops his carpet bag on the pavement and wraps his arms around her body.
I am your Max, Celie. I shall always be your Max.
He kisses her, and all the months of longing, of waiting, of dreaming, are in each press of his lips against her skin. Chapter 9. Etta. Piccadilly, London, May 1913. Etta huddles under her umbrella, skirting puddles as she hurries down Piccadilly as quickly as the narrow hem of her hobble skirt will permit, mincing past the bowed windows of Hatchard's booksellers, with its gilded royal warrant on proud display above the door, and the King's grocer, Fortnum and Mason, with its Easter display replaced with windows full of picnic hampers and a selection of teas under faux branches of lilac. The torrent has sent the Friday shoppers and businessmen scurrying for cover, leaving Etta with puddles rather than pedestrians to worry about in her hobbled rush down the street. In front of a pyramid of teas of the world in Fortnum's window, she waits for a break in the traffic. She sees her moment and, stepping awkwardly over a puddle collecting above a street drain, she shuffles across the street and under the archway to the Royal Academy of Art. The granite cobbles of the large courtyard are slippery under her feet, slowing her progress even further. By the time she makes it through the doors into the marbled lobby, the hem of her skirt is soaked through. The ticket seller behind the front desk, a thin-faced young man with round, black-rimmed spectacles and an expression of anxious irritation, eyes her dripping raincoat as he hands her a ticket to the summer exhibition.
"You might wish to leave your wet things in the cloakroom, miss. We can't have anyone slipping on the floor."
"Oh, no, of course not."
He exchanges her money for an exhibition catalogue.
"The royal family's picture is in the oils room."
"Oh, I haven't come to see that, though of course I shall."
The words spill out of her mouth in a flood of excitement.
"Mr. Rutter in the Sunday Times said that this year's summer exhibition is evidence of triumphant feminism."
She reaches into her handbag and extracts a much-folded newspaper clipping. She unfolds it and reads,
"A remarkable success achieved again this year by women exhibitors. Isn't that exciting?"
She fans her face with the catalogue as she catches her breath.
"I'm an artist, you see. One day, my work will be in here too."
The ticket seller drops the change into Etta's gloved hand and gestures to the person behind her.
Next!
Etta stands in front of Annie Swinnerton's, Peter, son of Sir John Grant Lawson, Baronet, having duly let her eye grow accustomed to the glare of bright sunlight, as advised by Mr. Rutter, in order to best admire the blaze of colour of the little boy on a pony.
"Do you agree with Mr. Rutter?"
Etta looks up at the tall man in a grey tweed suit and a high-collared shirt standing beside her. His black hair is waved by the rain, and his face is the warm tan of sunnier countries. He has a neat black moustache over his full lips. He smiles at her, his dark brown eyes shining warmly under his thick black eyebrows.
"I beg your pardon?"
He removes a newspaper clipping from the pocket of his jacket and shakes it open.
"Do you agree that this is,"
he squints at the small print,
"one of the most powerful and convincing works in the exhibition?"
An Italian accent rolls off his tongue in loops and swirls. A dimple forms in her left cheek.
"You've read Mr. Rutter too?"
"Of course. I think he is one of the most,
he waves his left hand as he searches for the word,
"progressive critics of art in London. I am always interested to read what he has to say when I am in London."
The blue ostrich feather in Etta's wide-brimmed black felt hat flutters as she nods.
"I absolutely agree. I read his column every Sunday when I can pry the paper out of Papa's hands."
She points to an exuberant painting of spring flowers.
"That must be Miss Browning's March flowers. Those flowers! They're the colours of joy after a long, dreary winter, don't you think?"
"It reminds me of Van Gogh's sunflowers."
"Does it? I've heard of Mr. Van Gogh from my tutor at the art college."
"Have you not seen any of his sunflowers paintings? One of them was at the Post-Impressionist exhibition here 3 years ago. A great many incredible paintings were on display. Manet, Cézanne, Gauguin, Picasso. It was, how do you say, marvellous."
"I'm sorry to have missed that."
How could she tell him she'd been 15 then, far too young to attend the exhibition the newspapers had branded pornographic, degenerate and evil? After she'd read those reviews, she'd made sure to visit the library to read whatever she could about those wild, passionate artists.
This is the way she wished to paint, from the very core of herself, though Mr. Lester, her art tutor, frowned at any innovation beyond the Victorian romantics.
The man leans forward to inspect the painting's brushwork.
"You can feel the artist's energy by the way she has used the brush and the paint so fearlessly. Like a spadaccina."
"A spadaccina?" The man nods his head, unleashing a black curl which strays over his forehead.
"How do you say, swordsman? She is like a swordsman with her paintbrush. Bellissima. This is much more beautiful than those horrible nudes in the watercolour room that look like they've escaped from a Victorian cartoon."
Etta feels the heat rise in her cheeks. Did he say nudes? Her heart rattles against the confines of her corset. She tucks the newspaper clipping into her handbag.
"Yes, well, it's been a pleasure, if you will excuse me."
Horror draws itself on the man's expressive face.
"I am so sorry, signorina. Please forgive me. I forget myself. I forget English women are more modest than we Italians."
He pats the tailored lapels of his suit.
"Permit me to introduce myself. I am Carlo Marinetti. I'm an artist from Napoli. I am in London for business, and I thought I would visit the exhibition to see what the English artists are offering."
He shrugs.
"Mostly, it's pretty pictures, I think. Nothing which disturbs. It is very..."
He waves a hand in the air. "Polite." Etta sweeps her eyes over the Italian. She should nod, politely, of course, and take her leave. She shifts on her feet. She absolutely should go. She offers Mr. Marinetti her gloved hand.
I'm Etta Fry.
Carlo raises her hand to his lips.
Miss Fry, it is a great honour.
My elder sister, Cecilia, is Miss Fry. I'm just Etta.
He releases her hand.
No, no, no. You are not just anything. You are... Sei bellissima.
He smiles, his teeth a flash of white in his tanned face.
I should very much like to see it.
I beg your pardon?
Your painting. When you exhibit here.
She laughs.
You heard me at the ticket desk.
Yes, I heard you. And I saw you.
I was just so excited to be here. I blurted it out. I think the poor man thought I was a lunatic.
Then he is blind.
Carlo offers Etta his arm.
May I have the pleasure of escorting you around the exhibition, Signorina Etta?
Her name rolls off his tongue like honey, dripping from a spoon.
This is a lovely name. In Italian, it means little.
Etta slides her hand into the crook of Carlo's arm.
I should like that very much.
Brava! We can talk all about the royal family and the unfortunate nudes in the watercolour room, and then I shall take you to tea.
Chapter 10. Jessie. Clover Bar, London, May 1913. The greenhouse in the back garden of Clover Bar sits gently decaying under the branches of a rowan tree laden with blossoms like posies of white lace. Jessie roots through the packets of seeds, rolls of twine, garden gloves and secateurs until she finds what she is looking for. She pulls out a long stick with a metal hook which has slid down the back of the shelves. Hooking the end through a loop on the pane in the glass roof, she levers the window open. She balances the stick on the potting shelf and nods with satisfaction. The seedlings of salvia, ageratum and zinnia are sprouting nicely. If the warm weather keeps up, she might plant them out in another week, though you never could tell in England. Ne'er cast a clout till May be out. Probably best to wait. She sets out a wooden tray and sprinkles in a layer of potting compost. Shuffling through the seed packets, she selects lettuce. She tears open the packet and tips the seeds into the palm of her hand. One by one, she pokes them into the compost. The wooden door creaks on its hinges, and Christina enters, shucking off her leather garden gloves. Her beige gardening smock is streaked with mud where she's been kneeling in the rose bed, and her large-brimmed straw hat, secured on her head with a violet cotton scarf, is askew. She drops the gloves onto the potting shelf and leans over the tray of zinnia seedlings, squinting as she inspects the delicate green shoots.
Those are coming along well, Jessica. I do so like zinnias. They're so jolly in the garden in late summer.
Celie says they're vulgar. She says they're like sweets in the candy shop, all bright pink and orange, without any subtlety or refinement. Christina hangs her hat on a hook. Cecilia is far too particular for her own good. She frustrates me no end. She has neither your drive nor Etta's charm. When she's not frittering away her time in your father's studio, she's burying her nose in German books. What use will that do her when she's married?
Jessie taps down the compost and shifts the tray to one side. The king is German.
Christina sifts through the seed packets and selects the French beans.
Be that as it may, the king was born in London, and his grandmother was Queen Victoria. That makes him English. You're more English than the king is, and you're half Italian.
And very proud of it too, Jessica.
I have my mother's Innocenti blood in my veins, as do all of you. If Cecilia had had any sense, she would have studied Italian. I still have relatives in Capri.
I thought the Innocentis cut us all off after Grandmamma ran off with Grandpapa. A Protestant Englishman, heaven forbid.
Not everyone. Mamma's cousin Stefania is lovely. She and Mamma grew up together in Capri. It's a lovely place.
When did you meet her?
Christina jabs a French bean into the compost.
How could she have been so stupid?
She visited London with her husband once when I was a girl. I think his name was Albertini. A very nice man. She told me all about Capri. She wipes her hands on her smock. Has Cecilia told you anything about a young man in Germany?
Jessie tears open a packet of carrot seeds.
No.
You're absolutely certain?
Jessie's jaw tightens. It's always about Celie. How she's such a disappointment. Or Etta, the apple of Mama's eye. She sets down the seed packet.
Mama, I've signed up for the Queen Alexandra's Imperial Military Nursing Service.
What?
Did you say military?
Jessie thrusts out her chin.
I was top of my class in the surgical training. Matron put in a word for me with them. She was in South Africa with the Queen Alexandra's during the Boer War.
Indeed.
Jessie swallows down the ball which has formed in her throat.
The Queen Alexandra's are army nurses, Mama, but we're not at war with anyone. I shouldn't imagine I'll be doing much more than patching up a few bruises and a broken arm or two on one of the army bases in the English countryside or abroad somewhere.
You can do that at King's College Hospital, at least until you marry.
Mama, I told you I want to travel and see the world. If I'd known you were in touch with relatives in Italy, I would have been very happy to cultivate an interest in Italian. Italy is no place for a young woman on her own.
Christina stabs a label into the potting tray.
Jessica, I'm not a fool. I've heard about the Zeppelin sightings along the coast. It was all the Jeffreys could talk about when they were here for dinner. What am I to think? One daughter in thrall to a German, and one bent on gallivanting around the world with the army. I raised you all to have happy, secure lives as good Catholic wives and mothers. It appears Etta is my only hope.
Good luck with that.
Why can't you simply marry a nice man and have a family, like I did?
Married women can't nurse.
Nurse here in London until you marry. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a respectable profession. Earn some money for your trousseau.
Papa would appreciate that. You know how he worries about money.
What about that nice young Mr. Jeffreys? His family's auctioneering business will be his one day.
Frank Jeffreys.
That was one time I actually felt sorry for Etta, Mama, having to sit beside him all night and listen to him drone on about French polishing and dovetail joints. If I ever marry, it will be to an interesting man, not a dull fellow like Frank Jeffreys.
Dull fellows have a great deal to recommend them, Jessica. They're solid and reliable, just like your father. He has never caused me a day of worry, other than when he was ill last winter.
Papa's not dull. He's artistic.
He is a photographer offering a service. Your father is a respected member of the middle classes. He is hardly an artist. It's fine for a young woman to dabble in art. Many young men are quite taken by a young woman with a talent for watercolours, but it simply isn't an acceptable profession for a gentleman.
Cousin Roger is an artist.
Your father's cousin was an artist. He has obviously seen the error of his ways and is opening a houseware shop catering to London's upper classes this summer.
Christina waves an empty seed packet in the air.
This is, by the by, Jessica. You are forbidden to become an army nurse.
Jessie grabs her gardening hat from the hook and slams it on her head. It's too late, Mama. I've signed up. As soon as I'm posted abroad, I'm going, and neither you nor Papa can stop me.
We certainly can and will stop you, Jessica.
You're not yet of age.
The greenhouse door slams. Christina watches her daughter duck under the rose arch and stomp down the gravel path to the house. She runs her fingers around her ear and surveys the garden. The graceful necks of the foxgloves wave in the light breeze, jostling with the billowing pink-flowered peonies. On the wrought-iron arch, the pearled azure clematis cloaks the white buds of the Madame Albert Carrière rose with a fall of blue mauve flowers. Everything is so perfect, just as it is. Why must her daughters test the patience of the angels? Angels can be truculent and spiteful, and no amount of Hail Marys and tearful confessions in the confessional appeases them when the mark has been overstepped. This she knows intimately. She will do everything in her power to keep her daughters secure and safe.
Chapter 11. Jessie. King's College Hospital, London, June 1913.
That's it, ladies. Straight backs, please.
Gerald steps away from the class of graduating nurses, whom he has arranged under the hospital's Doric portico. So crisp and efficient they look, he thinks, in their grey dresses and starched pinafores and caps. He scans the nurses to seek out Jessie's heart-shaped face. Her thick, dark hair is piled neatly on top of her head, crowned by the starch cap. She's much prettier than she thinks, with her strong features and green eyes so piercing that when she settles her gaze on you, it's like she delves past all the pretensions to the very core of your being. She's so much like his own long-departed mother, though there is no doubt she's Christina's child. They are identical in their willful stubbornness. You'll have to check the door hinges, after all the door-slamming that has gone on since Jessie announced her enrolment in the Queen Alexandra Nurses. It was all he could do to persuade Christina to attend the graduation today. He holds up the shutter release cable.
That's lovely, ladies. One, two, three, smile.
Jessie, is that Dr. Mitchell?
Elsie checks her cap and brushes a stray strand of fine brown hair off her forehead.
What do you suppose he's doing here?
Jessie glances at the tall young medical resident as she sips her elderflower wine. I suppose he's on his way to work. It is a hospital, after all, Elsie. Things don't stop simply because of our graduation. Elsie watches the young doctor's tall figure as he disappears through the hospital's entrance doors and sighs dramatically.
Good heavens, Elsie. Don't tell me you've gone through all of this training simply to find yourself a doctor for a husband. I thought Maud Phipps had that area covered.
Elsie sips the sweet wine.
There's no harm in looking, is there? I'm only human. Of course I intend to nurse Jessie, but I'm not like you. I have no intention of patching up soldiers in Timbuktu. I've been assigned to the obstetrics ward here at King's. Expectant ladies and babies suit me just fine. It doesn't look like I'll be off to Timbuktu any time soon. The Queen Alexandras have assigned me to paediatrics here. So much for exploring the world.
Paediatrics? You haven't a motherly bone in your body, Jessie Fry.
She clinks her glass against Jessie's.
Here's to the King's College Hospital's nursing class of 1913, destined to stay in Denmark Hill.
She gestures over Jessie's shoulder with her glass.
It looks like your mother has cornered matron.
Jessie spins around, splashing elderflower wine over her white pinafore in her haste. Her mother, resplendent in a new seafoam green hobble dress, has indeed cornered matron in front of the cake table. Although her mother's face is obscured by her large feathered hat, Jessie can easily guess, judging by the senior nurse's tight-lipped expression and the jabbing of her mother's seafoam green parasol into the clipped lawn, the subject of the conversation. Oh, crumbs.
"It's terribly amusing, Jessie. I've never seen Matron on the other end of the stick."
"Where's my father? He should have known not to leave Mama on her own."
"I saw him taking portraits in front of the college. I can't wait to see the one he took of me. Will it take long before it's ready?"
"I've no idea." Jessie shoves her glass into Elsie's free hand. "Wish me luck."
"Why do you suppose it was reasonable to put the ridiculous notion of becoming an army nurse into my daughter's head?"
The matron sets her shoulders back and lifts her chin as she prepares for battle. She peers down her angular nose at the agitated woman in the absurd hat.
"Your daughter is a talented nurse, Mrs. Fry. She has a rare combination of compassion, organisation, and aptitude for some of the more challenging aspects of nursing. Though, it must be said, she must apply herself to her timekeeping."
"I appreciate that Jessica is a good student. She is extremely competent. However, I must draw the line at army nursing." Christina stabs her parasol into the lawn.
"I have no intention of allowing my daughter to gad around the world with battalions of men."
The nurse presses her lips into a thin line.
"Mrs. Fry, army nursing is a perfectly honourable career. I nursed for the army in South Africa during the Boer War. The soldiers were most appreciative and respectful."
"It's not the soldiers I'm worried about. They're ill and hardly able to—"
Christina takes a breath to compose herself.
"There are doctors and foreigners."
"I have no doubt that your daughter is more than capable of handling herself, Mrs. Fry. She will be with other nursing sisters and matrons. You needn't have any fear of improprieties, if that's what's concerning you."
"Mama, I see you've met Matron."
The two women turn to stare at Jessie, like she's a teacher breaking up a childish spat. Christina nods her head stiffly, the peacock feathers protruding from her hat, jerking in the air.
"I have had the pleasure, yes."
Jessie attempts a smile and gestures to her mother.
"Matron, my mother, Mrs. Gerald Fry."
"Ah, of course."
The matron smiles stiffly at Christina.
"Your husband is the photographer. I hadn't made the connection, Fry being such a common name."
Christina's right eyebrow arches.
"I suspect the Fries with whom you are acquainted aren't related to the cocoa manufacturers as we are."
Jessie loops her arm through her mother's.
"Mama, shall we go find Papa? I hear he's taking portraits. Why don't we have him take one of us together in front of the college?"
"Jessica, your matron and I have been having a very enlightening conversation."
"Have you?"
The matron nods.
"I have been assuring your mother that you shan't be kidnapped and sold into slavery when you are nursing our brave soldiers in a remote corner of the world."
She smiles tightly at Christina.
"If you excuse me, Mrs. Fry, I have a duty to circulate."
Jessie watches the matron stride toward a cluster of graduates. She releases her hold on her mother's arm.
"Mama, I am becoming an army nurse, whether you like it or not."
"But Jessica—"
"I'm not going to discuss this any further. Now, I'm going to find Papa and have my portrait taken. You may accompany me or not, as you wish."
She juts out her chin, her body rigid with tension, as they stand in a silent stalemate. Christina offers her elbow to her daughter.
"I have spent a considerable amount of your father's money on this dress, and it should be commemorated in a photograph with my clever daughter. I shall discuss this with your father later."
Chapter 12. Christina. Capri, Italy, July 1891.
"Here it is."
Harry holds up the Baedeker red leather guidebook.
"The Arco Naturale is a natural limestone arch dating from the Paleolithic age and is the remains of a collapsed grotto. The arch spans 12 meters at a height of 18 meters above ground.
Isn't that beautiful, Cugina Stefania?
Christina's cousin fans her flushed face with a black silk fan embroidered with vibrant roses. She holds a Chinese paper parasol over her head in the other.
Yes, yes, very nice.
She sits down on a large rock beside the dirt path with a groan. Harry steps off the path.
Come look through the arch, Miss Bishop. Go, go, Tina.
Stefania presses her hand, protected by the ravages of the sun by a black lace glove, against her corseted waist.
Let me catch my breath.
Stefania watches the two young people pick their way over the scrubby grass toward the arch. Harry draws circles in the air with his arms as he expounds on its history. A handsome boy, in a broad-faced English way. The build of a labourer, rather than that of the slender, waif-faced aristocrats she's seen bathing by the marina or buying bread and cheese for one of their interminable hikes. The English do love their walks. A ridiculous activity in this summer heat, climbing all over the island's donkey paths. She waves the fan more rapidly under her hat. Christina nods and smiles as she listens to the boy. She is such a lovely girl, Stefania muses. So like Isabella and the daguerreotype her cousin had sent her all those years ago, after her marriage to the Englishman, a Protestant, no less. She never would have imagined such a thing of her childhood playmate. Isabella had been so timid, she'd even refused to play down in the grotto. So fearful was she of hearing the siren song. Things must have changed after Uncle Umberto emigrated with his family to Britain, though Isabella gave no hint of it in her letters. Every letter in Italian, with a full copy in English. She has Isabella to thank for her facility with the ugly language now. She dabs at her damp forehead with her gloved finger. To have been cut off by the family must have been a difficult thing for Isabella, but it was understandable. At least this James Bishop had made an honest woman of her before Christina's birth. Stefania shakes her head. Poor Isabella. Only 39 when she and the baby had been called home to God in February. Harry says something, and Christina laughs, the sound floating on the humid air like bells tinkling in a breeze. Flicking the fan closed, Stefania heaves to her feet with a laboured sigh as Harry and Christina trek back through the scrub grass and yellow flowering broom to the path. Harry pulls the Baedeker guide out of his jacket pocket.
Righto! The Grotta di Marta Magna is down the path this way.
You two go. Andare alla grotta. I have walked sufficiently today.
Stefania opens the fan with a snap of her wrist and fans her florid face.
I shall expect you back at the villa no later than 3 o'clock, Tina.
She settles a stern look on Harry.
You are invited to tea when you return, Signor Grenville. Liliana has made torta caprese with chocolate and almonds. I expect that you will not be late.
Christina picks her way down the steep stone steps that hug the cliffside. In places, the only barrier between a false step and a dramatic exit into the churning waves below is a shoulder's width of rocky earth sprouting tufts of grass and broom.
Good heavens! No wonder Cousin Stefania turned back.
Don't worry, Miss Bishop. There's plenty of room. I wouldn't put you in any danger.
Oh, do stop all this Miss Bishop nonsense. It's Christina. Watch where you're going, you nincompoop.
Harry gallops down the final steps. He holds out his hand to Christina as she descends onto the compacted earth in front of the grotto. Nestled within the arch of a limestone cave, a two-roomed structure of cobbled stone walls, inlaid with tiny mosaics of ancient glass, opens onto a view of the jagged Amalfi coastline and the turquoise sea.
Voila! We're here!
Christina steps up into the grotto and runs her hand over a cobbled wall.
This is probably the oldest thing I've ever touched.
Harry scans the guidebook. They believe it was where Cybele, the goddess of the earth, was worshipped. It would have been decorated with marble statues and coloured glass mosaics and seashells.
It must have been beautiful.
The Romans thought that these caves were where the sirens sang their songs to sailors to lure them to their deaths.
Really? I've heard of that. The siren song. Something so beautiful it can't be resisted, but it ends badly for anyone who hears it.
Though some say that if a person hears the siren song and escapes, the sirens are fated to die.
Oh dear.
They throw themselves into the sea.
How awful.
Harry steps up into the grotto and removes his straw boater. They say the sirens only sing in the middle of the day, when it's calm and quiet, so their song can be heard in its full beauty.
It's the middle of the day now.
He steps towards Christina.
Close your eyes, Christina. Listen. Can you hear it?
She shuts her eyes.
I'm not sure.
Her sentence is stopped by the press of his lips upon hers. Her eyes fly open, and she pushes him away. Christina, I'm sorry, I... She steps forward and reaches her hands around his neck. Then she opens her lips to his soft, warm kisses. Chapter 13 Etta Amiga Workshops, London, July 1913. Amiga Workshops Limited, 33 Fitzroy Square West. You are invited to an exhibition of decorative art at the above address. Examples of interior decorations for bedrooms, nurseries, etc., furniture, textiles, hand-dyed dress materials, trays, fans, and other objects suitable for Christmas presents. Etta fans her face with the invitation she'd received so unexpectedly from her cousin, second or third, or possibly something once removed, she wasn't quite sure, the art critic Roger Fry, to the opening of his new design showrooms in Bloomsbury. She's borrowed her mother's seafoam green silk hobble dress, which fits her quite well, though she is concerned the colour is casting an unflattering green shadow on her skin and pale hair. She has forgone a hat for a tumble of curls, through which she has woven a mauve silk ribbon in the style of the American film actress, Miss Lillian Gish, to whom she has been told she bears a striking resemblance. She accepts a glass of champagne from a young waiter with tousled brown hair and soulful blue eyes, who is rather disconcertingly dressed in a wrinkled beige linen jacket with a button missing on the left sleeve, though his emerald green silk cravat adds a jaunty note to his bohemian appearance. She hovers in front of a three-panel screen, painted with green-skinned bathers in a landscape of thrusting mauve and ochre mountains, and bends over to look for the artist's signature.
There you are, my dear. I see you've found Vanessa's screen. I'm afraid you won't find her name on it. I have a policy of all our pieces being anonymous. Objects and furniture should be valued for their beauty, rather than because of the reputation of the artist.
Etta looks up into the face of her distant cousin. There is a whisper of a resemblance to her father in the length and sharpness of his features, but the gullies of his bone structure throw a grey cast on his cheeks and shadow the brown eyes behind the wire-rimmed spectacles. A mass of wiry grey hair springs from a centre parting above his high forehead.
Cousin Roger, thank you so much for inviting me. It's quite amazing to be here.
She gestures towards a beautiful young woman with a pile of dark golden hair, clad in an exquisite beaded ivory gown.
Is that Miss Gladys Cooper of the stage?
Roger glances towards the young woman, who has attracted a coterie of admirers.
It is indeed. I shall have to go and speak to her in a moment. It all helps with the publicity.
He kisses Etta on her cheek
I'm delighted you could come, my dear. We artists must support each other, mustn't we?
Thank you so much for helping me to get a place at the Art College in Camberwell. I'm enjoying it no end.
You have a lovely talent, my dear. Talent must be nurtured.
I'm awfully sorry about what Mama put you through at dinner last week.
Roger chuckles.
Don't worry. Your mother's quite right to have her reservations about us lot. We do enjoy provoking bourgeois sensibilities and anything with the whiff of the status quo. I hope I managed to assuage her concerns now that I've told her I've become a humble shopkeeper.
You're hardly a shopkeeper, Cousin Roger. This place is amazing. It's like an exotic bazaar of wonders.
Roger, darling Roger, how are you, my dearest?
A woman of extreme height, capped by a mass of flaming red hair, bends to air kiss Roger on either cheek. The ropes of pearls twined around her long neck clatter like beads in a doorway. Swathes of violet silk drape from her statuesque figure, cinched at her waist by a jade green tasselled sash.
Ottoline, my dear, so glad you could come. Will you be joining us for dinner later? We're heading over to Vanessa's. She's here somewhere. I saw her come in with Duncan and Clive. Absolutely, darling.
The remarkable woman settles an intense aquamarine gaze on Etta.
But tell me, who is this delightful young sylph?
Forgive me, Otty. This is my cousin Etta Fry. She's an aspiring artist.
Etta, this is Lady Ottoline Morell, a grand patron of modern art.
Etta bends her knees in a curtsy.
Delighted to meet you, Lady Morell.
The giantess laughs, a deep, guttural sound which seems to rise up from her feet like water rising in a tide.
No need for all that, my darling girl. Just call me Otty.
She reaches a marble-white arm around Etta's shoulders.
Now, come with me, and I shall introduce you to everyone. By the end of the evening, your name will be on the lips of tout le monde bohémien.
She stops abruptly and sweeps her ethereal gaze over Etta.
You are a good artist, I trust.
I'm trying to be a good artist.
Excellent. You must come to tea and show me your work. Clive, darling, you must meet this wonderful young artist I've just discovered. Where's Vanessa? I must tell her how much I love her screen. I believe I shall have to purchase it for my boudoir.
Roger stands before a large curtained mural of elongated nymphs cavorting in an ink-blue forest and clears his throat.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining me and my co-directors and fellow artists, Mrs. Vanessa Bell and Mr. Duncan Grant.
He gestures toward a tall, attractive, dark-haired woman and the handsome waiter with the piercing blue eyes.
As we open the doors of the Amiga workshops to celebrate the creation of items for the interior, which encapsulate forms expressive of the needs of modern life. We believe that it is time that the spirit of fun is introduced into furniture and fabrics. We have suffered too long from the dull and stupidly serious.
I see you have found your way into the crema of the art world, Signorina Etta.
Etta jerks her head around to the unmistakable voice.
Mr. Marinetti, what are you doing here? Aren't you meant to be in Naples?
Obviously not, as I am here.
Carlo takes her hand and brushes it with his lips.
May I say, you are even lovelier than I remember. And in my memory, Botticella's Venus was a poor second to the beauty of Signorina Etta Fry.
Etta gifts him with her most winning smile.
You are very kind, though I think quite possibly blind, Mr. Marinetti.
He offers Etta his arm.
Come, let us have a promenade. I shall be exhibiting my work here in November. Help me to find the best location to hang my paintings.
Etta rests a hand on Carlo's arm.
Only if you promise to send me an invitation to the opening.
Cara mia, you are the subject of the centerpiece painting. As soon as I heard about the Omega workshops, I wrote Roger and demanded I be the first artist to hold a solo exhibition here. All so that I could see you again.
You did not.
I most certainly did. Did you not wonder how it came to be that an invitation to the opening that all London's beau monde wished to attend dropped into your letterbox?
But I thought, Cousin Roger... I don't know. I was just so pleased to receive the invitation. I didn't give it all that much thought.
Mama insisted he come to dinner, of course, to ensure everything was right and proper.
She gave poor Cousin Roger quite a grilling, but he passed with flying colours.
I would have expected nothing less of him. Roger could persuade King George to dance a tango.
Etta giggles, aware of the attractive dimple that forms in her left cheek.
I should like to see that.
You should like to see what, my dear?
Etta looks up into the gravely beautiful face of the artist, Vanessa Bell.
Oh, Mrs. Bell, I'm delighted to meet you. I'm Etta Fry, Roger's cousin. I love your screen.
I'm delighted. Roger's told me all about you. Another artist in the Fry family. The world cannot have enough artists.
Her voice is as deep and resonant as a tiger's purr. She turns her serious gaze on the Italian and leans in to kiss his cheeks.
Carlo, I wasn't sure you would make it in time for the opening. How long have you been travelling? It was nothing, Cara. I flew like the bird. The trains are so efficient now. I would not have missed this for the world. But I must return to Napoli in a few days. I am painting a mural in the house of a contessa there, and she is...
He smiles.
Very demanding.
Vanessa Bell raises an eyebrow.
Well, you must both come to dinner later. All our disreputable friends will be there. Duncan will ensure the aristocrats come, of course. We'll all get drunk and dance and kiss. The aristocrats will fear they're in the thick of things. I expect orders to flow in like a river. Vanessa, with an invitation like that, how can we possibly refuse? Wonderful. The German ambassador's wife, Princess Lichnowsky, has already bestowed names on all the new fabrics, and she's having Mechtilda made into curtains and bed draperies for her bedroom. I'm working on persuading her to engage us to redecorate the reception rooms at the German embassy. What a coup that would be.
Roger joins the trio. He slips an arm around Vanessa's waist, and the two exchange an intimate look.
Mechtilda fabrics for Mechtilda Lichnowsky. She's nothing if not modest.
Vanessa laughs, the sound almost masculine in its depth and resonance.
I shouldn't complain, Roger. She's exactly the sort of client Omega needs. Have you said hello to Lady Cunard? I saw her arrive with the Bertrand Russells a quarter of an hour ago. Of course. They'll all be stopping by yours for dinner. It will be quite the party.
Etta glances from the striking Mrs. Bell to the two men. She's meant to be home by 8. Mama had been quite adamant about that, but
a party at Mrs. Bell's. Finally, her life is beginning.
A work of art must have the power of making the outsider, whose eyes are the least active of his senses, aware of something real and exciting. Oh, Roger, you do run on sometimes.
Vanessa rises from her chair and tosses her napkin onto the table.
Come, everyone, let's retire to the drawing room for our coffees. Clive, darling, put a record on the gramophone. Something gay. What about the children, Pat? They're used to the racket. The boys could sleep through a hurricane.
She beckons to Carlo.
Carlo, come.
Accompany me into the drawing-room, and tell me all about life in the Città del Sole."
A young woman of about Etta's age, who spent the dinner engrossed in a conversation with a handsome, dark-haired man, with a gaze that Etta thinks conjures the worst kind of thoughts, leans towards Etta as Carlo makes his apologies and disappears through the doorway with Vanessa. Etta looks at the girl. She's not particularly striking, except for her large, expressive brown eyes, and for the fact that she's forgone a corset in favour of a loose-fitting dress, printed with an abstraction of multicoloured lozenges and circles. The girl extends her hand, which is hung with silver bracelets.
"I'm Violet Hayter. You must be Roger's cousin. I'm studying painting at the Slade. Will you be joining the college in the autumn? It's the place to study art, of course."
I'm hoping so. I shall need to secure some references."
Violet laughs, the sound light as feathers.
"That shan't be a problem. Just look who's here. The Bertrand Russells, the Lichnowskis, and..."
She nods towards her dinner companion as he sidles up to Lady Morel.
"The artist, Mr. Wyndham Lewis. His eyes are rather vampiric, don't you think? They suck at one's very soul. Do you see that tall, rather melancholy woman over there in the corner? That's Mrs. Bell's sister, Mrs. Virginia Woolfe. Her husband's here somewhere. An odd fellow, not handsome like Mr. Lewis, but a very good conversationalist for a civil servant. She's attempting to be a writer, but..."
The young woman shakes her head, which is crowned by a red felt tarbouche.
"She hasn't been well." She taps her forehead. "Something wrong up here. It is all very exciting to be here, but I don't know any of these people." "Oh, you will. I have a sense of these things."
The throbbing rhythm of a tango drifts out of the drawing-room.
"Come on, then. The music calls."
Violet tucks her hand around Etta's elbow, and they head towards the drawing-room.
"Are you a sensualist, Miss Fry?"
"Oh, I...
"You must be, if you're to be an artist. That's my view, at any rate. Artists must be attuned to the vibrations of the earth and all it offers. That's why I've joined Amiga. It's simply vibrating with energy, don't you think?"
"You've joined the Amiga workshops?"
"Yes. Roger has hired a bunch of us from the Slade as artist decorators to design pretty things and scurry around doing whatever needs to be done. It's pin money, really, and we aren't permitted to work more than 3.5 days a week so as not to be distracted from our painting, but one never knows who one might meet. I have a dinner engagement with Mr. Lewis next Friday. How lucky am I?"
Etta nods. Even she would be circumspect about attending a private dinner with Mr. Lewis. Violet stops abruptly under the drawing-room's archway.
"I've just had an idea. Why don't you join Amiga? Just ask Roger. No, wait. I'll do it for you."
The young bohemian releases Etta's arm and weaves her way around the gaily slip-covered chairs and tables, painted in an explosion of geometrics. Etta stands in the doorway. The room thrums with conversation and laughter. Lady Morel and Duncan Grant have commandeered a corner of the Persian carpet and are dancing an energetic tango to the claps and bravos of several of the guests. Violet has been waylaid by Mr. Lewis and has seemingly forgotten her mission to speak to Roger about a job for her at Omega. The floor vibrates under Etta's feet. She catches Carlo's eye. She watches as he extricates himself from Vanessa Bell and Lady Cunard.
"There you are, Signorina Etta. I'm so sorry, but I had to, you know, conoscere I propri punti di forza."
"Know which side of your bread is buttered?"
Etta smiles.
"I understand. I know a little Italian from my mother. You're here on business. Artists need buyers."
"I am afraid this is a reality of life. We must eat."
He takes her hand.
"Come, dance with me."
I'm afraid I can't.
Carlo looks at her, his dark eyes wounded. He presses a hand against the breast of his tailored black jacket.
Forgive me. I am un pazzo, a fool. I understand.
You understand what?
There is somebody else. I am only surprised the room isn't crowded with your admirers. My tragedy is that I live so far away from the most beautiful woman I have ever met.
Etta feels the blood rise in her cheeks.
Oh, no, it's simply that I don't know how to dance the tango.
His eyes flash as they sweep over her. He holds out a hand. Come, I shall teach you. Etta hesitates for a mere moment. It's well past 8. In fact, she's lost track of the time altogether, and who could blame her? She is among the most interesting, most bohemian people of London. She couldn't possibly leave now, with a party really starting.
I should be delighted, Mr. Marinetti.
I am your most humble servant, Signorina Etta.
Etta glances at the heads turning in their direction as he leads her into the midst of dancers.
People are looking.
Of course they are. We are the talk of the evening, cara mia. You have arrived.
Etta presses her hand against her fluttering stomach and peers through the taxi's dirty window at Clover Bar's shadowy facade. Slivers of yellow light cut into the dark summer night through the slats of the Venetian blind in her father's study.
Papa's still up.
She looks over at Carlo, whose dark eyes glitter in the cab's dull light.
What time is it?
He reaches for the chain of his pocket watch and holds it against the window to catch the glow from a street light.
Just after 10 o'clock.
She buries her face in her gloved hands.
Oh, dear, I shall be in such trouble.
Cara mia, don't worry.
He waves a hand in the air, like he is swatting a fly.
In Italy, this is nothing.
I'm afraid this is London. I was meant to be home by 8.
Then I shall accompany you to the door and take all the blame for myself.
Etta's hazel eyes widen.
Oh, no, I'd rather you didn't.
But Carlo is already out on the street. She waits as he rounds the taxi and opens her door. Carlo holds out his hand, and after a moment's hesitation, Etta takes it and steps down onto the pavement. He offers her his arm, but she shakes her head and proceeds up the tiled path ahead of him. She turns the brass doorknob. Panic rises in her stomach like bile.
It's locked.
You don't have a key?
I've never needed one. Someone's always home. I'm never out this late on my own.
It is not the end of the world.
He reaches above her shoulder and hammers the brass knocker sharply against the door. The seconds feel like hours to Etta as she waits for someone to answer. A jangle of keys on the other side of the door. The glow of a gas lamp through the door's leaded glass panes. The door jerks open.
Mama!
Christina stands in the doorway, holding a gas lamp, still in her navy linen skirt and white blouse, though she should have been in bed long before.
Etta, where have you been? Your father was about to leave for the police station.
She sweeps her eyes over the Italian.
May I inquire as to whom you are?
Carlo doffs his bowler.
Permit me, Signora Fry.
I am Carlo Marinetti. I am a friend of Mr. Roger Fry. I wished to ensure your daughter arrived home safely.
Gerald Fry joins his wife at the door.
Etta, thank goodness, dove. Your mother and I have been worried to distraction.
He holds out his hand to Carlo.
Very kind of you to see her home, Mr. Marinetti.
He gestures inside.
Please, come in and have some tea, or perhaps a brandy. Gerald, it's far too late for socialising.
Christina casts a cool look over the Italian.
You would excuse us, of course, Mr. Marinetti. I'm sure you understand.
Carlo replaces his hat.
"Of course, Signora Fry. It has been my great pleasure to make your acquaintance."
Christina stands in Etta's bedroom doorway, the glow of the gas lamp casting shadows around the room.
"What on earth made you think you could so blithely ignore your parents' requirements for you to be home by 8 o'clock?
Etta sits on the bed, picking at the white lace bedspread.
"I'm sorry, Mama. I was invited to dinner afterwards at the home of the artist, Mrs. Vanessa Bell. She's the director of the Amiga workshops with Cousin Roger. I'd intended to come home right after the exhibition, but it felt quite rude to decline. I didn't expect the dinner to go on as long as it did."
"Etta May, you are only 18. I can't imagine what Mrs. Bell and the other guests must have thought. A young woman of your age, gadding about London after hours on her own. It reflects extremely poorly, not only on you, but on myself and your father as well. Had you considered that?"
"I'm sorry, Mama."
"Your concept of responsibility needs to be re-evaluated, Etta. Your father and I had approved of your attending on the stipulation that you will be home by 8 o'clock. This you entirely failed to do. As a consequence, there will be no more of these jaunts to London on your own."
"Mama, please. I'm so sorry. The Amiga workshops are wonderful. I spoke to a student named Violet from the Slade, who works there part-time with some of the other art students. She thought I might work there as well. All I need to do is ask Cousin Roger."
"I'll not have you associating with bohemians. Who was that Italian man at the door?"
"He's an artist from Naples. He's holding an exhibition at Amiga in the autumn."
"You are not to speak to him again. Do you understand?"
"But, Mama, he's a perfect gentleman. He insisted upon seeing me home."
"Perfect gentlemen are the very worst type of men."
The bedroom door shuts with a jolt. Etta sits on the bed in the shadowy room. She'll speak to her father about working at the Amiga workshops. Not immediately, of course, but in a week or so. She'll get her way. She always does. And Mama can never stay cross with her for long. In the meantime, she'll be the best, most considerate daughter possible. She lies across the bed, careless of the wrinkles creasing her mother's borrowed dress. She will see Carlo Marinetti again. Of this, she is certain.